Hey everybody, welcome to the Diecast. I'm Seamus, and with me is Josh.
Why you always pick me first? Push me on the spot, and I'm like, I should be clever, and then I'm not clever.
Because you make everybody after you look good. People like...
God damn it!
Hey guys, I just flew in and my arms hurt.
Please die.
Damn it, Rutskarn. Alright, it's all on you, Mumbles.
What's up, my ladies?
Alright. Now we're getting somewhere, and Campster.
You can't see it, but I'm tipping my fedora towards Mumbles.
Oh,
oh my gosh!
Get out of here! Campster wins this week.
You'll never make it in the stand-up game, kid.
So, instead of talking about video games, let's talk about unrest. Rutskarn, how's unrest doing?
Well, the game's finished, so... You know, we've gotten to the point where it's like we're gently putting our hand on Mick, our artist and main playtester's shoulder and saying, Mick, it's okay. We can't really make any big scripting changes at this point. You know, it's just accept the consequences of releasing a game at any point, which is it will not work for someone somewhere.
Yeah, you know what? I feel like I've failed in my duties. Okay, Unrest is a game that Rutskarn is writing and that you kickstarted how long, a year and a half ago?
It was about a year ago, yeah. We just passed the 1 year anniversary maybe a couple weeks ago.
Okay. I forget. New people come to the Diecast all the time and we just like pretend that it's the same group of people. Yes. Yes. And then they're like, what? What is this?
No, Josh, our audience is slowly shrinking. Eventually, we will reach this singularity where it's one guy.
It's just one guy that's paying attention to us, and this is the only person on the internet who knows who we are anymore.
So, getting back to Unrest, the game is done as it's frozen. It's technically gone gold, if that means anything anymore in this age of digital sales.
We don't actually have, you know, we're going to be sending out physical copies to a limited number of backers, but, you know, the copy that we are that Steam is launching and that, you know, all the reviewers got, those are already done and they're out, and, you know, it's the game. What is what it is. And if that sounds, like, uncharitable on my part or, like, negative, it's really not. I couldn't really express an opinion one way or the other about the game right now, because when you've been developing something for this long, you don't know if it's good or not. Reviewers, like, who've gotten back to us seem to like it, so that's good.
You sell that game. You sell it.
Yeah.
If it is what it is, what is it?
Unrest is a role-playing game set in ancient India. You play a variety of characters, ranging from, you know, various mundane persons, like a peasant girl, or like a priest of sort of a controversial faith. In a city which is gripped with economic depression, the result of a long-running failure of the monsoons to come, political tensions, problems with immigrants. Yeah, basically, you sort of pass from character to character, viewpoint to viewpoint, and get dumped a whole new load of problems each time. And one of the features of the game is that there's not a lot of combat. In fact, there's no mandatory combat whatsoever. What combat there is very avoidable. But if you do die, and, you know, you can die plenty of ways that aren't combat, because, you know, if most of the time you're playing people who are very low on the social totem pole, and it's all too easy to get killed in that kind of circumstance. But if you do die, then the game just continues. You move on to the next character. It's incorporated into the part of the narrative. Basically, we sort of wanted to do the Walking Dead thing, where it's like, you know, there's divergent storylines. But since the Walking Dead have to have 5 episodes, which they release, you know, on a monthly basis, which, you know, maybe is 15, 20 hours long total, they can't actually make the outputs very significant, especially since they tried to do it, you know, as sequels and as, like, a series. You know, like, pretty much, you know, it's like I lost my Walking Dead Season 1 saves, and when I started Walking Dead Season 2, it's like, you know, I had just had a random save file. It didn't really matter how the first one ended for me, because nothing big was different. Unrest is different. We're trying to be very different. Like, we want how it ends to be very different depending on what you've done. We want your actions to actually have some kind of interesting consequences. And we can do that by making the game only 3 to 4 hours long.
Despite the fact that you are low on the social... Like, when you say very different, are you talking about just different text on the screen or different times and places and ways events that play out?
The events can play out a little bit differently. A lot of it is text on the screen. But, I mean, that's ultimately how the story's being told mostly anyway. This is an adventure RPG, and we don't have voice actors. So, I mean, you know, it's dialogue, it's intros and outros, it's, you know, like the epilogue, it plays out very differently. Like,
does it have like a Fallout 3 kind of epilogue for sections, like, and then here's
Fallout
what...
Fallout 3!
Not Fallout 3, Fallout 1, Fallout, original Fallout.
Although it's actually done in-game rather than out of, like, as sort of like a narrative aside. Like, people actually just sort of come to you with reports and or discuss things that are relevant to them in the final chapter and epilogue. And through that, you sort of get the sense of how things have ended. And, you know, by the standards by which RPG companies calculate this sort of bullshit, there's about 360 different endings, like, combinations. What that actually means is that there's 36 different ways one thing can end, and then there's like 5 different ways another thing can end, and there's 2 different ways another thing can end. And those are the big 3 things. And so, total, that's 360 different endings.
If this were BioWare, that would be on the box.
Yeah,
we're not putting that on the box.
And it would be a lie.
With romance options.
I will say that, you know, there's only one romance in the game, and it's more implied than anything.
What? There really isn't any romance options in your game? That's
well,
insane.
You can't well, I mean, there are people who are in love, but, you know, and maybe your character might be one of them, depending on how you interpret it, but we don't really have that as a side quest, no.
Interesting. Yeah.
I have a question for Rutskarn.
Yes.
Will there be DLC guns?
Obviously, yeah. You know, because every character in the game is Indian. We realize that it wouldn't appeal to Western gamers, so we have a DLC where you play all of the chapters, but as, like, a grizzled 30-something with a shotgun.
As Max Payne. So,
for example, in Chapter 1, John McTavish is told that he's been arranged to marry a merchant cast. And...
You're gonna play Soap in Unrest. That would actually be really funny.
Yeah, you have the options of peacefully accepting your fate, attempting to subvert the social rules in whatever means you have available to you, or gunning down all the pigs with your shotgun, motherfuckers.
But I have, like, a legitimate question.
Yes.
So how did you as the writer structure the narrative? Were you going for something cohesive across all of the stories, or were you more interested in having a series of really impassioned vignettes, or did you sort of have a bit of both, where, like, the individual stories have their own compelling arc to them, but then the overall game also has its own arc that plays out?
We sort of actually had a combined approach. I would say, like, so there's a couple chapters that recur, I won't go too much into that. Chapter 1 is very much like... The first chapter is like very much like a vignette. It's like its own thing, and then it does have impact on later chapters. The third thing, you know, it's a little influenced by what you've done, but it's a little more... So it's a little less of a vignette, but it's also kind of influenced by your actions thus far. And then the fifth chapter is very much like sort of following up on what you've done, but still portraying, like, a character arc. And then the final chapter is, you know, it's resolution... that it really is more dependent on what you've done so far. So the game kind of is a gradient from start to finish of those two options, with it being more episodic and self-contained in the beginning and less so towards the end.
That's kind of cool. Also,
yeah.
Combat, how do it work? Because I played the demo, and there didn't seem to be any, like, shotguns or things to pick up.
In chapter one, there's no combat. You're a 15-year-old girl surrounded by people with spears. There's like one weapon which is in the area, and like if you got a hold of it, what would you be able to do with it against people with spears? Like, I mean, yeah, they're gonna stab you before you can get in within effective range if you're just wielding
Remember,
like, a short
guys,
bladed
so
weapon.
Spears beat swords typically.
Typically, yes, unless it's like a Zweihander. But anyway. Point is...
Spears? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No. I want to know what you think about spears. It's very important.
Oh, no. I was just curious why Josh said spears are always defeat swords. Is that what you said,
well,
Josh?
Not always, but... We are going to go into a tangent about historical warfare here, and I am going to derail this whole podcast if we continue down this road.
You know, it's funny.
Uh-huh.
There's a chapter... There's a chapter where you play a peasant girl, and then there's another chapter where you play a mercenary captain. And I think there's actually more notes about historical warfare in the chapter where you play as a peasant girl than there is the one where you play as a mercenary captain. Because, like, you can talk to a veteran, and he tells you about the campaign he was in. And you're like, did you kill anybody? And he's like, no, mostly we just marched around to places, arrived at battles too late, and, you know, tried to keep from being bored while on the march.
So I will try to summarize this, but essentially, in most battlefield situations, a spear is generally a better thing to have around than a sword. You can be in formation with a lot of people with other spears and have a wall of spears that you can poke people with. And swords are generally not as good at doing that. I mean, the Romans had their swordman formations, but, like, for the most part, spears have ruled warfare.
But doesn't a spear do two extra points of damage? Oh, but it reaches an extra square.
Yeah, an important rule of thumb is that just about any historical weapon is not designed to hurt someone. It's designed to hurt someone before they hurt you and without them hurting you, in that order.
The reason swords have become, like, so, like, such a big deal in our mind for warfare is that, A, they are the only battlefield weapon that is an exclusively, like, a weapon that is exclusively designed to kill other people. Like, spears, you know, you can have a hunting spear, you can have a hunting bow, you can use an axe to cut down a tree, but a sword is just basically, you kill people with it, and that's it.
Yeah.
It's more expensive to make a metal sword than it is to make, like, 10 metal spearheads for a spear.
Yeah, more expensive to make, although towards the end of the period, you know, they had already made a lot of swords, so they were just kind of floating around, and you could buy one for relatively cheap. But, okay, let's get off this tangent for a little bit.
Okay, so how does combat work? Like, back to my original question, is it like numbers based? Is it like your choices influence a certain dice roll, or is it more just like?
Okay, so slight spoilers here. So if you don't want to know anything about the game, I'm not going to be specific. But if you want to know anything about the game, you know, skip this next part. I will give another gate where I offer more spoilers. And if you don't want to know anything about that, you know, if you don't want to know something maybe a little more specific about the game, don't listen to that part. I'm saying stuff that I wouldn't mind hearing before I played a game blind, but, you know, you might be different, so, you know, just be advised. Okay, so first spoiler, like minor spoilers. There are two combats in the game, or two potential combats in the game. One of them is you're in an area and you can choose to fight or not fight. You know, somebody is forcing a fight upon you, and you can sort of run away, or you can capitulate, or you can go down fighting. And that fight is, you know, all fights are controlled with, like, the WASD keys and mouse clicks for, like, blocking and attacking. It's not, you know, like, super fancy. It's, you know, it gets the job done. There's another fight where you have to instigate the fight. And it might go a little differently than you'd think it would. But, so, those are the two options. Now, to give slightly more spoilers, I will say that only in neither fight are you trying to kill the other person. You're trying to sort of stay alive, probably. You could kill lots of people in the game, but you don't do it by fighting them. You do it by ordering people to kill them. Or, like, you know, like you have guys standing nearby. You have an overwhelming force. You just say, kill those guys. You know, it doesn't really come up often that you're challenging people to single combat, because people go around challenging other people to single combat over and over again, don't last very long.
I don't know, I didn't notice any situations in the demo where my 15-year-old girl suddenly had an army at her disposal, so I'm not sure
it does not happen in that chapter. No.
It's DLC, Josh.
We did say that there wasn't going to be any DLC, but we have often discussed comedy DLC, which just reversed the chapter.
So, more interviewee questions, because I am being obnoxious. Are you and the team more interested during your development in interesting choices or interesting outcomes?
Ooh.
Interesting choices. And, like, we steer the game based not on what we want to happen, but on what we think players want to do. Like, I ask myself, like, okay, if this is a pen and paper RPG, what are five reasonable things that somebody would do in this situation? And I try to write for those options rather than, like, go, okay, what's the next set piece I want to have? You know, let's do that. But I did find that often...
I love this approach.
I did find that often the more interesting choices did have some slightly more interesting outcomes. There's a couple that are my favorites, but all of them are spoilers, so I won't go into that.
Do you think your game has more meaningful choice than that new Divinity game?
I have not played it, but somebody on Reddit did inform us that they didn't see the point to having our game in a post-Divinity Original Sin world.
Thank you, Reddit. It's...
I love
keep on
it.
Trucking.
I love it. In a world where we are elbow deep in shooters, you're going to question the existence of having two entirely different RPGs at the same time. Reddit, I applaud you. You are just...
I will say, I want to play Divinity Original Sin, but I actually can't afford it, so... maybe if the what? Game does well.
Hint, hint, everybody listening, hint, hint.
There are more direct ways to solicit video games.
Buy my
hey,
book!
Campster, you should buy Rutskern Divinity Original Sin.
No, it's $40. Okay.
I'll just buy 40 copies of Unrest and tell him to go buy it himself.
I don't make a dollar per copy.
Unrest is not $1.
I do not make a dollar per copy off of Unrest.
I also would end up spending something like $300.
That is a good question, though, and I will say that a lot of the alterations to later chapters, like, because, you know, we make it so that each chapter, you know, can end differently depending on how you do it, but, like, when things carry forward into the next chapter, it's actually very often that that stuff is stuff you wouldn't really think would, like, be relevant later on. Like, it's less like big obvious things, although, you know, sometimes it really is just big obvious things, although maybe not always in the way you would expect them to come back. But, like, it's often something where you're like, that's, like, the last thing I would think would have an impact on the later game. But, you know, that has an impact in a very logical and rational way.
So would you say the outcomes of your choices in the game influence the outcome of the world or the outcome of the characters more?
Probably, well, your choices within your situation affect your character the most. But the world is seriously, seriously affected by your actions. I mean, you know, I will grant, not entirely in, like, a visual sense, although there certainly are some arresting, you know, scenes that happen if you do something that don't happen if you don't. But, you know, how the city ends in the end, because, you know, it's all about the city of Imra, I will just go ahead and say flat out that there is a... Like, everything is pretty good, you actually did a great job with all of your characters acted in a way that would help the city out, you know, it's, you know, top drawer. And then there's another, which is, like, the darkest timeline, is what I called it in my script. Which, it's just, like, if you chose a lot of things that probably seemed pretty reasonable, but maybe slightly ill-advised, or, like, you know, you didn't really think about things that other people told you. Or what would happen, you know, you chose something that felt good, but maybe something wasn't smart, and it does not go well.
That sounds like me and every relationship I've ever had with Doritos.
They should just rename the game that, Campster and the Doritos.
No, that sounds like a Marlo Briggs title.
An Indian RPG about economic unrest.
Okay, so I was driving around lately, and I saw these posters at the 7-Eleven, where they have, like, they're, like, mozzarella bites, but with a breading made of Doritos. And every time I see one, I just feel my whole body seize, and, like, the scurvy start to set in.
Why are Doritos getting put into everything where they don't belong? Like, Taco Bell had the Dorito tacos, and, like, Dorito mozzarella bites? What? I don't
know.
No, they're cheese bites. They're cheese bites covered in Dorito dust. That's all they are.
Yeah.
Sold! Sign me up. I mean, that sounds gross. What kind of loser would eat that?
You know,
I'll have the salad.
If it wasn't 7-Eleven, I'd consider it. Like, if this was, like, some crappy Guy Fieri restaurant or friggin' TGI Fridays, fine, I'll eat your crappy Dorito-dusted cheese balls. But 7-Eleven...
You would get caught in a crappy
7-Eleven
Guy Fieri
might kill
restaurant.
You. I knew a guy who ate, like, what was it? One of those, like, things that 7-Eleven, like, heats up and puts on the racks. Like, one of their chimichanga. I don't know. Fucking, I don't know. Anyway, he ate one of them, and then his appendix burst instantly. The second he fucking ate something from 7-Eleven, his appendix burst, and they had to take him to the hospital. I'm not even making that up.
I don't know if those things are related.
It totally is related.
The appendix burst. I mean, there's not like enough time to get to the appendix.
No one knows what the appendix does. No one knows what causes it to burst.
It's a vestigial organ.
Okay. No one knows what causes it to burst. It could be 7-Eleven.
It could be the extreme flavor. It was the extreme flavor burst.
Actually, it was probably an organ that was meant to digest cellulose. So, unless you've been eating wood chips...
Well, no, because... See, Josh, you defined it yourself. The appendix is an organ that remembers, like no other organ your body does, the shit you're supposed to be eating. It's like, okay, what are we having today? Grass, you know? We can have, like, I don't know, some leaves. Maybe
dead
you can
squirrel.
Find, like... Yeah, dead squirrel, something like that. Just anything. What the fuck is this? What the fuck is this? This isn't food! What are you... Oh, I'm out!
This is what happened to that poor man. This is an exact reenactment. Thank you, Rutskarn. Well done.
The Rutskarn Town Players present.
If you tried to eat the food that the appendix says you should eat, you would die because you can't digest it because your appendix doesn't work.
Yeah, the appendix is basically the grognard of the organ systems.
All right, do we have anything left to say about Unrest?
It's available on Steam and Humble Bundle and directly from Pyrodactyl's website. You can get a DRM-free version.
You guys are rolling with, like, the... We also have our own store.
Yeah, I mean, some people like getting other DRM, so there's Humble Bundle and there's us.
Also, they...
Good Old Games?
Oh, also, Good Old Games, yeah, also Good Old Games.
Generally, when you sell it directly, you don't have to share with anybody else, so you make a little bit more money. So if somebody is willing to jump through the hoops of, like, well, I have a Steam account, but I'm going to, you know, and instead of doing the convenient thing, I want to do the slightly inconvenient thing and buy directly from the person who makes the game, you know, it's a little more hassle, but it makes them more money.
Yeah.
I'm recalling, I think it was Christine Love, the person who does did analog and digital and those other visual novel-esque games. When she was doing analog, she had her own storefront, and then by the time she did Hate Plus, she was like, fuck that, that is way too much work, it's just on Steam now.
Okay, I think it is time for some mailbag.
Yeah.
Okay, hi, I've heard Seamus say several times that YouTube Content ID can identify cutscenes, but not gameplay. I understand you don't have inside knowledge of Content ID, but do you see any issue with IDing a game by its HUD? Is it distinctive for every game? It is distinctive for every game and is always the same. Thanks, Joseph, but spelled with an F, which makes me want to pronounce it Yosef. So Yosef wants to know if it's possible to identify a game by its HUD, thus being able to content ID game footage.
Yes and no.
It's hard to say. I mean, as a human, it's easy to... It's absolutely possible to look at a HUD and go, oh yeah, that's Quake. Do Quake.
I guarantee you can do it, but the question becomes, like... I guess the question becomes, that might be too wide a net, though.
Well, hang on, Chris, because the whole point of a HUD is that it changes. Like, that's literally the only reason to have a HUD, is that the things you're displaying are subject to alteration at a moment's notice, hence, they needing to be in your face at all times.
If the HUD is semi-transparent, that would also throw everything for a loop.
Which they often are now. And would you even want to do this, even if you could? Like, what would be the gain?
Yeah, there are, like, a lot of games now, like, more action games that just have excessively minimalistic HUDs. You know, you have the ammo counter, and maybe, like, a little health counter.
And it only updates when it changes.
And let's say that you are suicidally determined not to have everyone play your game. Then you wouldn't use a HUD identification. You'd, like, put a watermark somewhere on the screen.
Yeah.
And then, like, that's how you identify game footage. And at that point, congratulations, you are just making your game objectively ugly to prevent people from marketing it on YouTube.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't see a problem with this, because this is the last thing anybody with a brain would want to do. It's like, we must put a stop to these YouTube
You're
players.
Assuming they have brains.
Okay, fair point, fair point. But, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, we've got to put a stop to these YouTube players that are talking about our game. Although, Nintendo is kind of trying to do that, and so I don't know.
Well, Nintendo has that, like, Disney complex. Usually, I find it's not we have to stop them from talking about it, it's some executive gets the idea that, hey, these guys are making lots of money off of, like, footage of our game, we should have that! And then they try to do it, and it just implodes everything.
Yeah, okay, that's fair. If they want to monetize all the gameplay, if they're stupid enough to think that makes sense, then I suppose, but they would be in a position where they would have to talk Google into adding that very difficult to detect system to content ID. I don't see Google wanting to bother.
Yeah,
I don't think
Google...
it's even frankly possible with a lot of games. If you had like a Baldur's Gate HUD, or maybe you were like StarCraft or something.
Look, people playing Minecraft on YouTube is like, that's like half of what's on YouTube. Like, 50% of the videos are just some dude from an indecipherable part of Europe playing Minecraft for his 600th video for a loyal audience of 40 guys.
Right. It should be noted that that is also the reason Minecraft got so big.
I don't know. I think you could do it. I think for a lot of games, you could identify the HUD using the same technology they use to identify video in the abstract. In terms of can you do it, I think for most games, the answer is yes.
I think probably the smarter thing to do would be to, like, have the loading screens. Like, have it recognize the loading screens.
Oh, that'd be good, yes. And you could nail the, you could make your loading screen really distinctive, effectively a cutscene, and then let's players would have this annoying thing where they'd have to go and edit out all the loading screens.
Oh no, encourage everybody to edit the loading screens out of your footage.
Actually, that'd be a really good idea. That'd be really good. You'd ensure that all of your Let's Plays are super high quality.
It's a really subversive thing to get the public consciousness to think that your game has no loading screens.
Okay, next question. So, sales of the Xbox One appear to have doubled since June. Really? I did not know this. Which is when Microsoft...
Three people bought them? As opposed to one guy and one guy walked into the... One guy and one guy walked into the GameStop, asked if they had Xbox Ones, and said, maybe next year.
They've doubled since... Okay, they've doubled in their... The total number of sold hasn't doubled. I'll bet what this person is saying is that the rate at which they're...
Sales per month.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They've doubled since June, which is when Microsoft stopped making the Kinect mandatory as part of the package. My question, how much do you think the increase in sales is simply because of the price, and how much do you think it's because people flat out didn't want the Kinect and didn't buy it because of that? Best regards, Jared.
Probably both. I mean, like, simultaneously, I don't care about the Kinect, and also, hey, it's $100 cheaper.
I don't think the Kinect was stopping anybody, or it was probably stopping some people. I don't think the Kinect was stopping lots of people from buying the system. I think it was the fact that it's $100 more expensive.
Yeah.
When you've got another console that's just launched, that's, as far as Joe Consumer knows, just as good and is $100 cheaper, that's just a deadly, deadly flaw.
Yeah. When you cut the price by $100, it gets it in the news. And then somebody looks at it and they're like, oh yeah, the Xbox One is a thing. Did any good games come out for that? Because I remember that it was really dry when it came out and I didn't want to invest in it.
The next sports game.
Oh look, oh, here's a couple games that I want to play. Alright, yeah, sure, I'll buy one. Why not? That's what's happening.
I mean, I do think, though, that, like, it's not that people actively hate the Kinect, it's that, like, people don't give a shit about the Kinect, which is probably a big part there, too, because, like, hey, I can buy an Xbox One for $100 cheaper, and all I have to do is get this, not have this camera I don't care about on it that has really silly games.
I did actually know a person who was very angry that they were releasing a version of the Xbox One without the Kinect.
Was she an early adopter that really hated the Kinect?
She claimed that it was that they were abandoning the Kinect, that it was the most anti-consumer thing they could do to remove to create systems without one.
Abandoning the Kinect, yes.
By not anti-consumer, making you...
no. If the consumers don't want the Kinect, which they apparently do not, and they're showing Kinect-enabled games.
If they kept shoving it down people's, throats, eventually they'd realize how good it was.
That's how the Virtual Boy became the most well-sold system ever. Oh wait,
what's up, Chris?
As the only person here who actually owns an Xbox One, I will say that while the Kinect is more or less terrible as an actual games interface, and there are very, very few games that make it play anything close to decent, as a voice activation module, it's okay. It hits about 80 to 90% of the time when I say Xbox do something, it does it. And that's really convenient.
That's convenient, I guess, but that's also still kind of an unacceptable percentage. Like, if my mouse failed to click on something 90% of the time, I'd be outraged.
Well, I mean, there's something about a convenience factor of when me and my wife sit down to watch a movie on, like, a random night, and she gets up to go to the bathroom, and instead of me having to sit up and go, all right, where's the remote? I don't know. We can just sit there and go, like, hey, can you pause it? Pause, and it stops.
The problem of hunting for the remote in a dark room, where you put it down and it was still light in the room, but now the sun has gone down and you're in the middle of a movie and you've settled into the deepest part of the couch and you're right in the middle of an important scene and the phone rings and it's like, oh, where's the control? Oh, stop. I don't want this scene to continue. Oh, crap. Now I'm going to have to rewind. Oh, yeah, I can see the utility of just being able to stop it right there.
Also, the fact
on the other
that
hand, that's audio. That's audio. You don't need the expensive part of the Kinect for that. You need a microphone.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't think
if they came out with a microphone attachment once the Kinect ultimately fails.
I don't think the utility is necessarily worth $100, but the fact that it also is designed to be a console with a TV pass through and being able to, like, you know, my wife comes home and I'm playing Dead Rising or whatever, and it's like, well, she's home, time to stop playing video games because she wants the TV, and being able to just say, Xbox, watch TV, and have it instantly switch without any, like, having to power off the console, find the remote, hit switch input down 3 times to cable, being able to just go, Xbox, watch TV, and it switches, and I can just get up and walk away, and my game is perfectly safe where it was. It is pretty powerful. I don't know if it's $100 worth of powerful, but it's not terrible. Like, it's something I use, I guess. I'll put it that way. I actually use it.
Can you do that by just using the controller instead? Can you hit the home button and go?
You can, kind of, but it's, like, clunkier, because you have to, like, hit the home button, and then it takes you to home, and then you have to find View TV, which is not always necessarily on the home screen, because their home screen is terribly designed, and then you click the View TV button, and then it switches over. So you can do it, but it's, like, eh.
Mm-hmm. Does the Xbox One's like home screen look basically like the 360s? Because the 360s has always been terrible.
No, it's all Metro based. It looks exactly like a Windows Phone now.
Of all the things that needs a touch based interface, you need it on your television console.
Microsoft, you are so Microsoft.
So what's the next question?
Okay. Actually, I'm going to skip this because it's I think we're going to actually want to give that one a little more time. Okay, I'm curious why Assassin's Creed is the only Assassin's Creed game that has been done. Okay, because we would get too angry and we would just swear at the game forever, and it would be a horrible season, and everybody would say, well, if you hate the game, why did you decide to do it in the season? I think we've all vetoed all Assassin's Creed forever.
Wait, what is the question?
Why didn't we do more Assassin's Creed?
I mean, I've kind of floated the idea of doing Assassin's Creed 1, but yeah, again, it gets... The problem with the Assassin's Creed games is that they've all got that Ubisoft, like, super manufactured open world thing going, and we would all get really bored really fast.
Yeah.
I don't know, I kind of like Assassin's Creed 4 and Liberation. And Liberation's short enough that, you know, you could do
a short thing
on it.
I mean, well, when I say I think they're good games, I mean I estimate that they are good games, not actually owning the relevant consoles.
I might be willing to do Black Flag, but there's no way I would do any of the games with Ezio in them. Oh my gosh. Oh, that was the dark period of that series, and I just get so angry every time I read anything of it. So that would be a terrible idea.
The problem that it had was that Assassin's Creed 2 wasn't super dumb unless you started thinking about it.
We also enjoy playing games that have some like narrative hooks we can kind of get into and explore.
Yeah.
Like even Skyrim, yeah. You know, we can go into what they're doing with their plot and their themes. And Assassin's Creed's story is just so boring. It's just the epitome of like good for AAA, which actually means that they have a team of very dedicated arson writers creating this vast, inscrutable canon. This vast, inscrutable, very complicated, bloated canon represented by stilted and, you know, just not terribly good dialogue, where it reads, the whole thing reads like an entire run of X-Files episodes condensed into 8 hours. And it's just, it's no good.
The Animus was a cool idea at the beginning as a sort of way, as a grounding method to keep this, like, setting that people didn't really know a whole lot about, like, also kind of grounded in, like, modern day so they could comment on it and kind of explain what the hell's going on. They should totally get rid of it now.
Yeah. I was thinking about that, actually. Like, if we did do something like Black Flag, it'd be like, oh, okay, we're going to follow Kenway on his adventures, and we're going to talk about Kenway and what he's doing, and then 20-minute break where we mock the crap out of the Animus because we're in the future, and then back to, oh, Kenway, okay, what's going on?
Yes, that would definitely happen. I was doing that when I was playing Black Flag, like, sitting here just like, what are you doing? You know, I was having fun, do you mind, asshole? I was playing a video game, get out of my way! It's like having somebody stand in front of the TV while you're trying to play a video game. Oh, makes me so angry.
Spoiler warning for Assassin's Creed 2 here, but do you guys remember when, like, we got to the Pope fist fight? And I was actually like, holy shit, there's really a Pope fist fight in this game. I thought everybody
was
joking.
Didn't believe me.
Because it's like, people told me that you fist fight the Pope, but I thought that was like hyperbole and it means that you fight a Pope. But no, you fist fight the Pope.
What even? That's the other thing, is I would just rant because the sci-fi hook they gave us in the first game is nothing like the ridiculous pulp that they paid off with. And I can't help going into every game expecting them to deliver on that whole idea of the first game. And
they never really did.
They never did, and I keep waiting for it. It's the same problem I have with Mass Effect. They started off with Babylon 5, and they ended with Fifth Element. And I can't make that jump. I'm still waiting for you to, you know, deliver on your original Star Trek vibe or your original sci-fi vibe, and you've gone off the rails into this broad, disjointed pulp, and I just refuse to go there. And so I just rant the whole time.
I've got sort of a dumb question. I remember Assassin's Creed 1 as not being, like, a huge hit. I remember it coming out and, like, it wasn't like, a big deal.
It was not huge, but not small. It was mid-tier-y, I guess.
Yeah. I feel like Assassin's Creed 3 was really where it started kicking off.
Wrote a fairly relatable main character in Ezio, not what's his face? Dude, I can't even remember his name.
Desmond.
But in Ezio, you know, like a kind of like your typical Hollywood like boyish rogue that doesn't age for like 25 years.
He's a boyish rogue, but with like he's a boyish rogue, but with an appealing somber side. He has he sobers. Like he's not just like Miguel and Tulio-ing the entire time. You know, he can sort of he takes things seriously. And that was pretty good, but I don't know if I needed 5 games.
The plot was dumb, but, like, maybe people don't really care about that. And then they took that, and they were like, holy shit, this character is way more popular than we expected it would be. Let's make a lot more games with this character, until they had just completely derailed whatever overarching plot they had set up. And then Ubisoft decided that it should totally be a yearly franchise. It's by the time Assassin's Creed 3 came out, there was like nothing remaining of the original Assassin's Creed idea there.
No. And I hate it. Yeah, everybody loved Ezio, and I hate Ezio. I think he is morally reprehensible. He is the most narcissistic, selfish asshole in the game. The world revolves around him, and he murders hundreds of people getting to the main bad guy, and then instead of killing the one person that would make the world a better place, he decides he doesn't feel like killing anymore, and so he lets the evil bad guy live.
Even though he killed three people 5 seconds ago to get to that guy.
Yes. It's like, screw you, Ezio.
History demands that the Borgia Pope doesn't die for another, like, 7 years.
Right, but then don't make a story. Make Ezio try to kill him and fail. The way they wrote the story, Ezio is morally reprehensible and disgusting. Especially with all the other assassins just helping him along and encouraging him, and they, like, we created a secret conspiracy to make sure that you can get here and do the job, and then when he gets there, he doesn't feel like it.
No, I don't want to kill anyone any longer. 5 years later, he's training child assassins.
Like, yes.
Teams. Yeah.
Oh.
Exactly that.
Oh.
Also,
Ezio,
how about that
Ezio,
giant alien antechamber in the Vatican, you guys?
Can we move on to the next question?
Oh,
I feel like we've answered this one pretty well.
Okay, Assassin's Creed now, so we can talk about this.
So that's why we don't do the Assassin's Creed game, because it's incredibly popular, and I would do nothing but rant, and I would get nothing but hate back in my face. Why are you hating on this game? If you hate it so much, why are you playing it? So that's why we don't do it.
Also, historically, while the Assassins may have killed 7 or 8 anti-popes, they never got in a fist fight with an actual pope. So, I just want to point out how historically inaccurate that is.
Anti-popes, I love it.
No, that is actually a real thing. There were anti-popes where a European ruler doesn't really like the pope, so he sets up his own pope and says, no, this is the real pope, and then occasionally those popes would actually become real popes, and it's...
Whoa.
It is really silly.
That doesn't work if a pope and an anti-pope get too close to each other, wouldn't they annihilate each other?
Well, you just kill the other pope first, and then...
Never mind. Dear diary,
see, the pope gets into a fist fight with the anti-pope.
They're wearing gloves, so they don't ever make proper contact.
I see. Dear diary cast, I'm a huge fan of the show. I love you, ShamWow, Mumblo, Bogo, Peepants, and Buttscarn. Wow, I like that they remembered all
Bogo.
Of our alternate...
Which?
Yeah.
Wait, one of those is Buttscarn?
That's
I've
Campster,
been wondering for a while,
obviously.
What do you guys think of linearity in games? And I can see where this question is going. Aren't games supposed to be interactive? Why are linear games, Half-Life, for instance, praised so highly when they offer very little player input?
Fucking kill me. You know what? You guys do your little Assassin's Creed fucking HUD, whatever that is, fucking Half-Life discussion. I'm gonna go smoke a cigarette. I don't smoke cigarettes, but I'm gonna go do it right now.
You're going to start smoking just so you can take your 5-minute smoking break.
I've been sitting here for 20 minutes listening to you idiots, and I just can't do this anymore. Oh my god. Alright, go. No, what is it?
That was the end of spoiler warning.
What does he mean by linearity? What is that?
Yeah, well,
what?
And then after all that, like, there's like 3 questions there, and then basically this, how do you feel about, quotes, corridor shooters? Thanks, Forrest. And, well, it depends.
Wait, that's what it was leading to?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean,
it depends on the corridor shooter.
Yeah, because that's the thing. Nobody says that games should be one thing, or, well, people do say that, but they're generally speaking, they're being really pointlessly reductionist. The games should be one thing or should be another thing. I mean, interactivity is important, but a corridor shooter has plenty of interactivity. You know, a corridor shooter still has more potential outcomes than a game of chess. Because
like BioShock
you could
Infinite.
Fire your gun at any half instant at
like,
any particular
like
point.
Like BioShock Infinite, the best BioShock game that's ever been made.
BioShock Infinite.
Do you like themes that don't make sense? Do you like going around corners and shooting dudes, and then going around another corner and then shooting dudes, and then going around another corner and shooting dudes? Yeah,
yes.
That's fucking
BioShock
Infinite.
Do you like
powers
that are all exactly the same power?
All exactly the same power.
Do you like knowing that a character is 10 times, maybe 100 times more powerful than your protagonist player, and then when you get a player in the DLC, she fucking can't do anything except for sneak around bad guys? Yeah, me
that
too.
That was the only good thing me that too. Came out of BioShock Infinite, though, so...
No. I was pissed. I was like, she has all of these powers. Think of how crazy you could get with that game. Like,
can't
just
you
like,
drop
oh,
them
I'm
into
gonna
another
warp-
dimension?
Right, like, keep dropping into new dimensions, bring in, like, a tractor. Like, I need to kill these splicers. Here comes a tractor. You know? Like,
summon
you
can- an anvil to drop on their heads.
Here comes something from the 80s, because apparently I have a portal to the fucking 80s.
You might be onto something here. I seem to remember somebody resigning from Irrational Games in protest over how well they were... Oh, right, it was Irrational Games.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
God.
I just...
I should not I laugh just... at that, but...
But back on sort of topic of the question, I think... The nope. best comparison I can think of is that,
no,
like...
No, we don't like this topic.
Well, I mean, if
go
you
ahead,
look at the job,
ahead.
Of the job of somebody who makes films, the point of the filmmaker is to position the camera in a way that uses the framing of the shot and the selection of lens to sell a point. That's how film works as a medium. And, you know, you add movement to that. You add the movement of actors, the movement of characters, and mise-en-scene, and you have and editing, and you have a movie. The point isn't to record everything. The point is to record things in a very select way that sells the point you're trying to make. And I think it's the same way with games and interactivity. The point of games isn't to simulate the world. The point of games is to pick the mechanics or the systems you want to talk about, the things that you find interesting or engaging or even just simply fun, and boil those down into a game. And the point isn't, you know, we need ultimate choice of everything. I need to be able to pick the color of my clothes. I need to be able to pick the direction I go. I need to pick the kind of car I arrive on the level at. It needs to be, you know, whatever the developer...
I need to pick if I arrive on the level at all.
Well, you know, that's what... Well, seriously, that it's not about giving players maximum choice. That's not the point of games. Interactivity is the way in which games allow players to interact with them, but... Well, that sounds redundant, but you know what I mean. It's not that games are interactive and therefore more interactivity is good. It's that games are focused interactivity. They're systems that are sculpted and designed to let players interact with them in specific ways. So if a game is linear and cuts off specific choices, look at that as a artistic or creative choice. Why does Half-Life function as a linear corridor shooter? And the answer is to provide you with a more quote-unquote cinematic experience where you're walking down a hallway where we can do these scripted sequences and push the narrative forward. Whereas if it was something more open world, you'd arrive at something that looks more like an ARMA game that's, you know, go wherever you want and shoot wherever you want, but they're kind of, you know, not very cinematic. Or you could look at something like Far Cry 3 that's more focused on emergent play and emergent shooty bits and not really focused on narrative at all, and when it focuses on narrative, it's a racist train wreck. My point is just more interactivity is not necessarily an a priori good in games. That's all I wanted to say.
Okay. I don't think I could top that answer, so I'm just going to shut up.
Yeah, I was sort of fucking around with my, like, more outputs answer that was going somewhere, but, like, it was going there, but not as good, so let's just move on.
Okay, Chris nailed that. So
I think we should
okay.
vote Campster off the island because he makes the rest yeah. of us feel inadequate.
I know I'm feeling inadequate. Rutskarn, as one of the people incredibly interested in both writing for video games and Unrest, I've always wanted to see a sort of detailed description. This is a confusingly worded question because it sounds like he's saying he's one of the people that's interested in writing for games and Unrest. But he's saying, I've
always
wanted to
see... I get what you mean.
It
sounds like it was directed to me, but then he talks about... Okay, yeah, but... Easy, yeah, okay. It probably made more sense when you read it, but anyway, go ahead.
I've always wanted to see a sort of detailed description of the process of writing for a narrative-heavy game. Would you be interested in doing a sort of writing of Unrest series once the game is out? Keep on writing, kill Fareth.
I absolutely intend to, but just so I can give you the short version now. Basically, first, in my case, I got a plot outline. It was boiled down into 5 chapters, and we sort of, like, that was basically what we, that was the game as he had it laid out. Secondly, I wrote up like a couple sample conversations to make sure that the conventions were the same, you know, that like how I was writing the scripts and organizing them made sense to the people doing the scripting, as in like the putting them to code. And, you know, I then started writing up a draft where I would like, honestly, like I came at it pretty half-cocked at first, where I would just like write up a conversation and then like write some italicized notes, like, and then this stuff could happen or you could go do this, but that quickly became way too constricting. So once we sort of, I sort of figured out what the fuck I was doing, because nobody really told me how to do it, I'd kind of figured out myself. We got to the Kickstarter phase, we needed a new outline, and it proceeded in a much more organized fashion. It went like this. First, I write up a, like, pitch for each chapter. Second, I write up a flowchart for each chapter, which has a rough sort of organization of the story beats. I also write up flowcharts for side quests that you can engage in theoretically anytime, along with notes on their conditions. Those get pitched, edited, revised, they go through the other devs voice any concerns, you know, if they have any, like, I don't know if I can draw that much stuff, or, like, we don't have the animation budget for that, you know, something like that. That didn't really come up too often, though, because we knew the team and its limitations pretty well. Once that happened, I basically just started writing out dialogue scripts that I wanted to have. We need a conversation with this guy, then another conversation if that quest goes this way. I would fill out the conversation trees, then I would write very complicated, detailed sort of guides to scripting and organizing the game. I'd draw up drafts of the levels. Those would go to the map makers. The map makers would, you know, make them however they, or make it however he saw fit. And we'd sort of put it together, fudge it, write new stuff as it was necessary. Yeah, that's basically how it broke down. Oh, and then, you know, once all that's in, then you go through and you write all the tooltip text and the journal text and the inventory item text and the trait text and the achievement text and the store page text. And until you hate language and words.
All the fun stuff about game writing.
Unrest's script is 120,000 words, and I would estimate that at least 10,000 of those are things that, like, you would not think of as writing.
Good lord. Having just spent, like, 2 weeks or 3 weeks writing an 1,800-word script, that's a lot of words.
It is a lot of words. My record was, I wrote, let's see, I actually wrote about 9,000 words in 2 days once.
Oh my god.
That wasn't good for me, like, my wrists. Wasn't a good times, but it was sort of necessary at the time. So
I think the only people that write more than that are people that do BuzzFeed articles.
It depends on the writer. It's been said that Stephen King pumps out even more than that a day, and given the size of his books, that would have to be true. But it depends on how well you write in your first draft, how much of the story you've got in your head. It's way easier to churn out a huge volume of writing if you've already got the key points mapped out in your head, where if you're kind of making up the story as you're writing, that's much slower, and there's, you know, so how much editing is there? Are you a just plow forward and write all the words and then I'll go back and bang it into shape later, or are you the kind of person who basically wants to have it correct when you put it down the first time and everything else is just proofing? So a lot of it depends on what sort of writer you are and what kind of writing you're doing.
Yeah. How long did it take you to write the Witch Watch?
The Witch Watch?
Well, and that would be weird.
I actually wonder that myself, because, I mean, I would have some days where I would write a few thousand words, and I would have some days where I could barely get a couple hundred words on the page, and it depended on how much of the next part of the story was formed in my head. And when I kind of realized that once I know what I want to do next, the words come very quickly. I can just sit down and bang out thousands of words. But, and I'll think, oh, I did thousands of words today. I'll come along tomorrow and do more thousands. But no, in order for them to come like that, I need to spend a few days not writing, but thinking about the story. So it's almost like I can do a 5,000-word push every few days, as opposed to I can, you know, sit down and I can't just work on it steadily and make it part of my daily routine to write a block of text every day. I have to wait know what's going to happen next, and then write it in bulk. And right. I don't think that's common for a lot of writers.
And now I want to go back and replay The Novelist.
So, I'm very similar to Seamus, although I did not always have the option of waiting. But if you want to know how long a conversation took to write, the average conversation took probably somewhere around 3 hours. You know, the average, like, decent-length conversation took somewhere around 3 hours to write. And sometimes it would be like, you know, if I could just sort of keep focused and not get distracted, I can, you know, drill through, you know, the more tedious parts and then, you know, like, put it together. And then sometimes it goes off on a tear that I didn't anticipate. The process of writing my kind of conversation tree is very chaotic. The trees are very organic. Like, it's not... Unrest doesn't have, like, a... You know, like, a dialogue system where, like, you pick topics and then you exhaust a topic and then you pick another topic. Like, it has, you know, conversations that start and then they continue and then they end and they branch off at various points. So, often the branches would kind of surprise me. And that was fun. That was usually when I would sort of sit up and pay attention.
How do I choose Paragon in the conversations?
I told you about that, right?
What's the Renegade Interrupt?
Like, I actually told you guys that happened.
Yes.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay. I think you've said it on the diecast, actually.
Yes, so I'm not going to go into that again.
The point is, we keep making the same damn joke about the game, so...
Yes. Anyway, that's if you want to know more, you can actually send me an email, you know, rutscarn@chocolatehammer.org, but I'll probably be putting out a series not too long after the game launch.
I look forward to that.
Is the conclusion of that series how to get angry at Reddit posts? Because that's like the conclusion of everything I do.
I can't explain how to do that. It's a gift of mine.
really? It's actually easy. All you have to do is read Reddit. Conversely, the way to avoid that is to not read Reddit. My health advice to you.
It's probably about all
meanwhile,
we have time.
Meanwhile, Mumbles is out back in an alley smoking a cigarette going, God damn those guys, I hate those guys.
She's through half a pack by now. She's going to die of cancer this week, and it'll be your fault, Chris.
Damn it.
I'm back. What did I...
Come back next week for a live stream of Mumbles X-Rays.
Surgeon Simulator 2014!